Praise God that His grace is greater than our sin. It's good for us to rehearse our sin, but it's even better for us to rehearse His grace. I grew up in an era where there was a lot of things put in cereal boxes. I don't know if they just don't, maybe we just don't buy the right cereal anymore. I'm not sure, but, and I remember distinctly one of those with a big conglomeration of letters scrambled on the back, and inside was the decoder ring, right? So that I could read this meaningless stuff on the back of the cereal box. It was a wonderful thing, right? We sometimes have those experiences in life, albeit maybe not as dramatic, but we have times when something clicks, right? And we're able to see it. Maybe it's schoolwork, right? And you're struggling with math or getting a concept, and someone helps you to come to a point, and all of a sudden the light kind of comes on, and it comes together in your mind, and you get it, right? One of my favorite sports movies is Hoosiers. Don't tell me if you haven't seen it, because I'll think less of you, all right? So, but this is in Hickory, Indiana, small town. New coach comes to town, and has some rather unusual practices and methods, and there's a big controversy in the town because Jimmy Chitwood is the best player in town, and he's not playing basketball for a variety of different reasons, and the people of the town want coach to go and get Jimmy Chitwood to play. That's the only way we'll ever win. And of course it plays out, and everyone's upset, and people are quitting the team, and he won't let them touch a ball. He wants them to just work on conditioning, and then when they do touch a ball, he only lets them pass and not shoot. But finally, right, you come to a point where things begin to click, and you kind of get it, and I understand what's going on here, and the team starts to get it, right? So you'll have to watch the movie to no spoiler alerts, but Jesus is doing something like that here in Luke's gospel. He's creating and helping them to think in new ways. He's intimated this even at the end of chapter 5. We're going to be in chapter 6 today, but at the end of chapter 5, he closes with this great statement about you can't put new wine in old wineskins. In that day, they would put the wine in these skins, and as the wine, of course, would ferment, the wineskins would expand. But you can't put new wine into old wineskins, because the old wineskins are expanded as far as they're going to expand, right? All that's going to happen there is that they're going to burst. And so Jesus is talking to them about the fact that in order to understand talking about, you've got to develop some new containers. You've got to think in some new ways here. I'm going to stretch your thinking to point you to God's true intent in His Word. And so we begin to see that unpacked here in Luke chapter 6. Now, again, as we step into this point in Jesus' ministry, Jesus is growing in fame and renown. Matter of fact, at the end of chapter 5, we have three encounters with the Pharisees, the religious leaders of the day. And with each encounter, there's a growing antagonism. In the first encounter, they're thinking to themselves. They're starting to wonder about some of these things, but they don't really say it out loud. And then in the second encounter, they begin to grumble among themselves. And then in the third encounter, they overtly begin to critique and question Jesus. They start posing, they start pushing back verbally on Jesus' teaching. And that trajectory continues here into chapter 6, so much so that by the end of this section, those Pharisees, those religious leaders, are now actively, strategically plotting for His demise. All right? So you got to have that sense of opposition here in the text. Now, both of the we're going to look at two controversies here in Luke 6, 1 through 11, both of them, the common thread is the Sabbath. Jesus is using this as the case study to start to unpack the revolutionary nature of his ministry. And so we need to understand this concept and make sure we have a handle on it. It's not one that is talked about a lot in our culture, even in the church in our particular time in history. And so we're going to take a few moments, go back to Genesis chapter 2, and just make sure we understand what we're talking about when we're talking about the Sabbath. What does this mean, right? So here it is, Genesis 2, verse 1. Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. And on the seventh day, God finished his work that he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work that he had done. So God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it, God rested from all his work that he had done in creation. I want to highlight just a few things out of this foundational passage. The first is that Sabbath involves stopping. God, we're told in this text, God finished the work of creation and rested. So God did not cease all activity. He did not go into a comatose state or go into a nap for the rest of human history. But he did stop doing that particular work of creation that he had done on those first 6 days. So that's part of Shabbat. The Hebrew word Shabbat means to cease or to stop, to desist from a particular activity. We also see here in this foundational passage that Sabbath is a gift. We are told that God blessed the Sabbath. It's a day of joy and fullness and feasting. Any restrictions are ultimately for the purpose of human flourishing. So we have some rules in our house about dinner time, right? And what, you know, devices need to be left at the charging station or somewhere else, right? But you don't bring them to dinner. That's a restriction. It's a, we tend to think restrictions are negative. And yet, I think we could agree that that's actually a good thing. To carve out space for actual conversation, right? This is good. This is healthy. So I think we could think of the Sabbath in a similar sort of way, that it does involve some cessation, some stopping, but it is ultimately a gift. It is a blessing. It is for our good. We also see here in this Genesis passage that Sabbath requires time. God established the Sabbath as a 24-hour day. He did not set aside a 15-minute nap as his Sabbath. He did not say that, you know, going to a church service would constitute some type of Sabbath or some type of rest. It's a day. It's a pretty robust concept. And I believe the sense is that it takes time. Rest, rejuvenation, the nourishment that we need in our souls doesn't happen momentarily, right? You go through the busyness and the chaos and the frenetic activities and demands of your week. You don't just shut that off in a moment, right? Like a scuba diver who goes deep but cannot come back up quickly, right? You have to come up in stages. Or that it's not pretty. Okay, I'm told, I'm not a scuba diver, but I'm told that you have to come up slowly. You have to decompress. And in God's wisdom and his design, he established a day. And my conclusion is that it takes a day to really rejuvenate from the other 6 days of the week. So it requires time. Sabbath should be distinct. Here's another concept that flows out of this text. It says there that God blessed it and made it holy. And that's what holy means, is distinct, set apart. It was distinguished from the other 6 days of the week. It was to be different than the other 6 days of the week. So again, it It was not a day of inactivity. It's not a day of doing nothing, but it is a day of different activity. In the ancient world, most people were engaged in manual labor. They were on their feet all day. They were working in the fields or in the workshop. And so that meant that you didn't go out into your fields like you did the other 6 days. You didn't go into your workshop like you did the other 6 days. You didn't take your product out to the market like you did the other 6 days. And as we challenge you to think about what that looks like, what Sabbath looks like in a context where maybe many people sit behind a computer or they sit for a good part of their day, we have to process through what it would look like for the day to be different than the other 6 days of the week. That's a key part of what Sabbath entails. Finally, Sabbath was designed for humanity. It's designed for humanity. We generally associate Sabbath observance with the Jewish people, but I would simply point out that God established the Sabbath at creation, long before he called Abraham as the father of the Jews. I'll acknowledge and put my cards on the table and just recognize that there's a great deal of diversity in terms of how we understand this concept for Christians today. All right. So it's okay if you're, you know, reaching into your purse for a tomato right now. All right. And you disagree and you don't think the Sabbath has any bearing for Christians. But I'm pointing out and I'm suggesting to you that it's not simply a Jewish thing. It's a human thing. Right. And if we tease that out just a bit further, I would make these following observations, that it was expounded in the Ten Commandments. Right? Two main reasons for Sabbath observance when you read the Ten Commandments in both Exodus and Deuteronomy. In Exodus, there was the connection there with creation. So observe the Sabbath or remember the Sabbath. For in 6 days, God created the heavens and the earth. So when you observe Sabbath, you remember that there is a God and it is not me. That God is the creator and I am a creature. Right. And we just recognize that. I put down my attempts to keep the world spinning. Right. And I rest in the fact that God is creator. So that's part of what's accomplished in Sabbath. One of the reasons it's important. Also, it reminds us of salvation. For the Jewish people, when we read in Deuteronomy 5 in the Ten Commandments there, it was to remind them that they were slaves in Egypt and God delivered them with a mighty hand. And in the Christian church, we recognize the Sabbath on the first day of the week now because that points us to an even greater deliverance, a deliverance from sin and death. It reminds us of the resurrection of Jesus Christ and the fact that death has been conquered. And so these are part of the reasons of why Sabbath is so important. We are no longer under the condemnation of the law. We're reminded of that in our worship time today. We no longer stand condemned by the law. But God's unchanging moral standards have not changed. So we don't justify idol worship or murder or stealing or lying or coveting just because we live now under grace. And I find it curious that we are so quick to dismiss the Sabbath command. It has been regularly practiced by the church through the ages, the Sabbath, that is. We could look in different places for this. I wanted to cite here today the Westminster Confession, which is out of a Presbyterian context. 1647. We could look at the New Hampshire Confession. There's a doctrinal statement that many Baptistic churches would have endorsed and followed. That was 1833. We could look at a wide range of different documents. But the Westminster Confession gives us a sense of how this has been understood in the context of church history. Now, let me say before I even read it, sometimes people got it wrong in church history. Can we just say that? So we always come back to what? We always come back to Scripture. All right. But I think it can be helpful to at least consider the perspective of those who have gone before us. Right? We don't want to engage in what C.S. Lewis called chronological snobbery, where we think that just because we live in a certain time in history, we have it all figured out. There certainly ought to be a humility to look and see how those godly men and women before us have understood the Scriptures. So, Westminster Confession, this Sabbath is then kept holy unto the Lord when men, after a due preparing of their hearts and ordering of their common affairs beforehand, do not only observe a holy rest all the day from their own works, words, and thoughts about their worldly employments and recreations, but also taken up the whole time in the public and private exercises of his worship and in the duties of necessity and mercy. So you see that little section there at the top. Again, separating ourselves from our works, words, and thoughts about our worldly employments and recreations, about the things that occupy our other 6 days, right? Some attempt to step away from those things and set the day apart. Finally, as we just continue to think about the implications of the Sabbath for humanity, I'm going to suggest to you that the Sabbath was modeled and taught by Jesus. And I list this last because it leads us back into our text this morning. And at first glance, as we read these verses, it appears that Jesus is denigrating the Sabbath, that he is doing away with it, that he is disregarding all Sabbath regulations and designs. But upon closer examination, we see that Jesus was actually observing the Sabbath and explaining its true intent, helping them to look at this again in a new way, right? With the decoder ring, having a true sense of what Sabbath really means. So in my mind, the question is not should we practice Sabbath, but what does it mean to practice Sabbath? How does this concept play out in our lives? So two things from the text this morning, two episodes, again, both centered on the Sabbath, and each one we're just going to point out one overriding lesson. All right. So in this first section, I'm going to suggest to you that Sabbath was intended for our good. I think this is the lesson that Jesus is trying to convey. The Sabbath was intended for our good, for human flourishing. Let's look together. Luke 6, verse 1. On a Sabbath, while he was going through the grain fields, his disciples plucked and ate some heads of grain, and rubbing them in their hands. But some of the Pharisees said, "Why are you doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath?" And Jesus answered them, "Have you not read what David did when he was hungry, he and those who were with him? How he entered the house of God and took and ate the bread of the presence, which is not lawful for any but the priest to eat, and also gave it to those with him. And he said to them, 'The Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath.'" So the Sabbath was intended for our good. The disciples are eating grain. We don't eat grain in sort of this natural form very much, but we have to think of it maybe like we would shuck corn or we would shell peanuts or something, right? There's this outer husk that has to be removed. And so there's a little bit of a process to it. You're not just simply popping it in your mouth. You have to stop and get the outer shell off first. As we think about this activity of the disciples, we probably have different questions that come into our mind. Like, what were they doing walking through this field? Whose field was it? Did they have permission to eat the grain that was being grown in that field? But the issue here is not one of trespassing or stealing. The issue is related to the Sabbath. The problem was that they were doing this on the Sabbath day. This was a day on which you were to cease from your normal labors. You're not to harvest or thresh on the Sabbath. Now, the law of Moses, specifically the Ten Commandments, are very concise on the Sabbath command. It doesn't give a great deal of detail. But fortunately, The rabbis of the day had developed a series of different additional restrictions to help make sure that you follow the Sabbath command. 39, to be exact, different restrictions and prohibited activities. And according to the rabbinic tradition, plucking heads of grain and rubbing them between your fingers constituted harvesting and threshing. You're doing major manual labor. Better have your deodorant on, right? I mean, this is heavy stuff here. So this was the perspective of the rabbis. So they confront Jesus and they say, why are you allowing your disciples to violate the law of Moses by working on the Sabbath? Sting operation here. They'd been watching. We don't know how they, if they were trailing from a distance, if they were hiding in the bushes, but somehow they see that this is happening and boom, they're on it. They finally have found something that they can pin on Jesus to discredit him, right? In reply, Jesus reminded the Pharisees about the familiar account of David and the bread of the presence. And by the way, in both of these accounts, I find it fascinating that Jesus poses questions. I'm not sure I'd be posing questions if I was Jesus at this point. But he does. He draws out these skeptics and forces them to think through their position and their accusation in a very powerful way by means of a question. So he draws their attention to the account of David out of 1 Samuel chapter 21. Now, this is before David was King David. At this point, Saul was the king, and David was on the run from Saul, running for his life, as a matter of fact. And he and some of his companions end up going to the tabernacle, to Abiathar, the high priest, in hopes of finding shelter and food. They were in a hurry, they couldn't stay long, and they ask specifically if there's any bread that might be readily available. And Abiathar says the only bread that we have is the bread of the presence. Within the tabernacle, just outside the Holy of Holies, where the Ark of the Covenant was kept, there was a table with bread placed upon it. And the bread was replaced every week. And when the bread was removed, it was only to be eaten by the priest. This was outlined in Leviticus 24. But Abiathar offers this bread to David. He says, this is the only bread we have. And he asks David a few qualifying questions, but offers it to David. And David and his men eat it. And end of story. They're not punished. There's no tribunal that is convened to debate this. And so Jesus in this question is making them think about David. And if they're going to condemn Jesus, they're going to have to also criticize David. You see the power of the question to sort of recast and make them think about it in a different sort of way. And you can bet they were thinking long and hard about how they were going to answer this, because they didn't want to throw King David under the bus. And so this moves the conversation forward. And then Jesus adds this final declaration that the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. Obviously, he's referring to himself as the Son of Man. But what does he mean by this? What is he saying? Is he saying that he, like David, have a special status and that they're able to override the Sabbath? Is that what Jesus is saying here? I want to direct your attention briefly to Mark's gospel. Mark includes this very account. But Mark includes a little phrase that Luke does not. And I think it's helpful for us to understand Jesus' statement when we think about a broader context here. So this is what it says in Mark's gospel. And he, Jesus, said to them, "The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. So the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath." So that little underlined part isn't in Luke's gospel, right? But it's pretty profound. The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. The point is that God didn't create us humans to serve the Sabbath day. God created the Sabbath day for serving us humans, for our good, right? And Jesus, as the Son of Man, the consummate human, is able to perfectly demonstrate how we should utilize the Sabbath. Jesus doesn't say, I am Lord of the Sabbath because I am the Son of God. He doesn't claim the deity card here. He says, because I am the Son of Man, because I'm the consummate human, I'm able to be Lord of the Sabbath. So he's drawing their attention to this by means of this question. The Sabbath was never intended to keep people hungry or in an abject condition. It is a day in which we are to receive needed rest and nourishment for human flourishing. It's not a day to go hungry. It's a day of joy and celebration. Craig drew attention to the fact that this is the first Sunday of Lent, and Lent is a 40-day period of time leading us up to our observance of Good Friday and the cross. But it's interesting, if you count the days, it started on Wednesday, and if you count the days up to Good Friday, you're going to end up with more than 40. And that's, again, because the Sundays don't count. The Sundays are feast days. They're mini Easters. And I think that's such a great picture for us to just understand God's intent for the Sabbath, a day of joy and celebration. It's been placed at our disposal to be used for our good. We have a need for rest and nourishment and rejuvenation. We need to step away from the unending demands and busyness of the other 6 days. We have some practices in our house that help us do that. Our kids complete homework on Saturday. Sunday's a joyful day, right? I don't read my normal stuff on Sunday. I have Sunday reading that is like stuff I want to read. it's fiction. I'm reading a book on Susanna Spurgeon right now. I love reading historical fiction, right? And so it's a different sort of day, allowing our minds to be refreshed and renewed. And it is for our good. Secondly, quickly, Sabbath was intended for the good of others. Sabbath was intended for the good of others. Let's look at this second account here. On another Sabbath, Luke 6:6, on another Sabbath, he entered the synagogue and was teaching, and a man was there whose right hand was withered. And the scribes and the Pharisees watched him to see whether he would heal on the Sabbath so that they might find reason to accuse him. But he knew their thoughts, and he said to the man with the withered hand, "Come and stand here." And he rose and stood there. And Jesus said to them, "I ask you, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm, to save life or to destroy it?" And after looking around at them, all he said to him, "Stretch out your hand." And he did so, and his hand was restored. But they were filled with fury and discussed with one another what they might do to Jesus. So as Jesus is teaching in the Sabbath, on the Sabbath in the synagogue, there is a man there with a withered hand. And the Pharisees had taken note of this. They were on high alert, wondering if Jesus would attempt a healing on the Sabbath day. The various, again, rabbinic traditions did allow for healing when there was some threat to one's life. You could exert yourself if someone was dying. But this man had been in this condition for some time, perhaps since birth. And if Jesus was going to heal, it could certainly wait another day, to a normal business day, right? And Jesus, perceiving their thoughts, asked the man to stand in the center of the synagogue. Jesus addresses the elephant in the room head on. And he asks this man, he asks them rather, the Pharisees, a pointed question. He says, I ask you, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm, to save life or to destroy it? Here's my paraphrase of what Jesus asked them. This man has suffered with this disability for years. I could heal him today, but you're telling me that God's intent for the Sabbath is for this man to continue suffering. What exactly do you think God intended the Sabbath for? Obviously taking a little license there with Jesus' words, but he's got the man here. Here's the case study. He's asking, you really want me to believe that God's intent is for this man to continue in his disability? Jesus asked the question and gazed at them. Mark's gospel says he looked around at them with anger, grieved at their hardness of heart. He stared them down. And I believe part of what Jesus is doing here is pointing the finger back at them. While Jesus was seeking to do good and to save a life, by their conniving and plotting, they were seeking to do harm and to destroy a life. Right? Who's violating the Sabbath here? So Jesus draws their attention to the fact that the Sabbath is not only intended for our good, but it's intended for the good of others. It's intended as an opportunity and a context and a day in which we are to serve other people. My daughter Abby was home from college this week on spring break, and she had a good time connecting with friends. She connected with another friend even this morning before first service. And so she was using one of our cars to bebop around, and as is usually the case, we also had some driving requirements for her to take kids to different practices and things like that over the course of the week. That's part of having a license, right? You get freedoms, which is good, but there's also some responsibility that comes along with that. And God didn't give her a license or give her the abilities that she has just to serve herself, right? Just to have fun with her friends. And I think it's a helpful way to think about the use of our own time. Yes, God gave the Sabbath for our good, for our personal enrichment and rejuvenation. But he's also given us the Sabbath as a day to serve others. It's a day of gathering for corporate worship and encouragement, a day for engaging in ministry and service to one another, to serve in the nursery, to go to Oxford Manor, right? These are all really great uses of the day and serving other people. Just a couple takeaways. Our time is gone this morning, but some of you like to have these note pages filled in. We should be thankful that God established the Sabbath for our good. We should be thankful that God established the Sabbath for our good. It's a gift. Use it. Right? We should remember that law is intended to help us love God and to love our neighbor. Ten commandments even, right? Remember Jesus was asked about this? What is the greatest commandment? Love the Lord your God, love your neighbor as yourself. He gave a summary of the commandments. Any attempt to use the commandments in a way to keep someone in bondage is an improper use of the commandment. So again, Jesus gives us this new lens of thinking about the law and how it guides us, provides some guideposts to help us love God and love neighbor. We must guard against stubborn pride and callous unbelief. I am just struck by the progression here in the lives of these Pharisees. Again, back from chapter 5, right up through this text, in the face of miracles and all these demonstrations of Jesus' power and his true identity, they are unflinching in their pride, unwilling to back down. And I found myself realizing and confronting my own selfish tendencies, my own pride. It's a discipline to maintain a sensitive conscience, right? And this whole idea of the new wine being poured into old wineskins. Are you an old wineskin? Are you a new wineskin? Are you one that's responsive to God's truth, even when it doesn't fit your box? We can all have a bit of Pharisee in us and being more comfortable with what we know and what we like and with the status quo than what God is seeking to do. And finally, the Sabbath is a great day to be healed. It's a great day to be healed. Jesus said to these Pharisees, in essence, you think I'm violating the Sabbath by healing this person. I'm telling you that I would actually be fulfilling the best intent of the Sabbath by healing this person. It is a great day to be healed. It could wait till tomorrow, but why? This is a day of joy. It's a day of feasting. My friends, we have a much greater malady than a withered hand. In our natural state, we are dead in our trespasses and sins. The Sabbath is a great day for God to save a life. You're here this Sunday under the hearing of the Word of God. Jesus is willing to save those who will come to Him in simple faith, acknowledge their brokenness, and be healed. This is God's heart. This is God's heart for you today. And it would be a joy for you to respond to that great offer of salvation and find eternal healing.